Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 27, the podcast from Strategic Analysis Australia on all things defence and security here in Happy Australia. I'm Michael Shoebridge, and I'm joined by the Director, Head of Research, Dr. Marcus Hellier.
Sorry, am I Director or Head?
Yes, you are.
Okay, I'm both. I'm the Directing Head of Research.
The Directing Head, or the Head Director?
Head Director, of I research. Like that one.
Of research.
My massive staff will like that. Yeah.
So we have a few things to get through. We're going to talk about a concept that's very applicable to defence procurement and, in fact, defence capability. And shitification, I think, is the word that you've found. We're going to talk about the gullible goldfish phenomenon, a bit about Henderson Precinct shipbuilding stuff, and a bit about missiles, $7 billion missile announcement.
And the ghost fleet, the Arafura OPV, where is it now?
Well, I thought that was covered under the concept of enshittification.
It is. I guess you're right there.
So this word you found, you didn't make this word up, did
No,
you?
No, but hang on. You're trying to change the subject, Michael. There is an important matter of business we have to cover. We talk a lot about accountability here. We're going to have an exercise in accountability here. I want to draw your attention, Michael, to the fact that in our last podcast, we referred to The Princess Bride.
Yes.
Great movie. Ooh. And there is that quote there. I do not think this word means what you think it means. And I think the word in question in the podcast was accelerate.
Yes.
Because defense seems to think accelerate means slow down. But anyway, you ascribed that quote to the character Fezzet, played by the professional French wrestler Andre the Giant. As one of our eagle-eared listeners kindly pointed out, it was, in fact, the character Inigo Montoya, played by Mandy Patinkin.
Oh, I feel terrible because Inigo Montoya has had a life of suffering and things done to him that shouldn't have happened. So let me apologize, not just to our listeners, but to Inigo himself, because he's one of my personal icons and I do feel awful.
Sorry, that's the extent of accountability.
No, I was just about to say, I think the problem here is I trust too much. One of the many interns here at Strategic Analysis Australia may not have done proper research, so I really feel like I'm the victim.
Which intern are we talking about here?
Well, they're not here now.
Right, okay.
Yeah, I feel bad, but I really think I'm the victim.
Well, I think, Michael, to show true accountability, you need to fall on your sword. I expect your letter of resignation on my desk tomorrow morning. But could you please edit the podcast first and put it on the website before you go and then be gone?
Well, I will commit to that. But yeah, we don't have any interns here at SAA. That was my mistake. Absolutely my mistake.
No. More obfuscation. Where is this heading?
I was thinking robo-debt, Afghan war crimes.
You've clearly
recruiting.
Clearly
you know, the
much of your career in the Department of Defence.
Well, so I think process was the problem.
Deep-wired bad habits there, Michael.
Process was the problem. There's no single individual who can be held accountable.
But if you were an unaccountable individual in defence, by now, after leaving defence, you would be the chairman of the board of a very large arms company. So the analogy doesn't work that
well. It doesn't work. Anyway, my apologies. So why don't we start? Enshittification is something that's come out of the tech world, isn't it?
Yeah, so enshittification was actually the American Dialect Society's 2023 Word of the Year. I'll give you a very brief definition taken from Wikipedia, the source of all wisdom. Enshittification, alternately crapification or platform decay. Platform decay, it doesn't quite have the same resonance.
It doesn't have the same
pattern in which online products and services decline in quality. Initially, vendors create high-quality offerings to attract users. Then they degrade those offerings to better serve business companies and finally degrade their services to users and business customers to maximize profits for shareholders.
Ooh.
So they suck in customers and business providers.
So they capture
like
and
eBay.
Build the market. Capture and build the market.
Yeah.
And then just degrade it all.
Yeah. So first of all, you suck everybody in to use your platform. They get hooked on that platform. They've got sunk costs on the platform. Then you start screwing the common guy, the customers.
Yeah. Yep.
But then by putting in more advertising, like you do a Google search now, you know, and at the top are all these ads. You know, you have
are they ads?
And you don't know.
I thought it was just genuine objective results. Oh, that's the sponsored link thing.
Right. You poor sucker.
Yes, I get it.
So but then they start screwing the business users as well, like on eBay or Amazon, and they start jacking up the fees for them as well. So everybody loses except the platform provider at the middle.
You know what I'm thinking?
The key thing is then the platform provider dies as well.
I'm thinking of Defence's Enterprise Resource Planning Initiative brought to us by the mega corporation SAP, which was all things to all people when it started. It was going to do logistics, finance, personnel. It now looks like it's being just continually de-scoped and extended and delayed. So it's a perfect example of what you're talking about.
Well, I agree, and I think when you look at defence, you can see all kinds of examples, but to me, probably the most relevant example is actually the shipbuilding program. You know, so if we cast our minds back, this was meant to solve everybody's problems. It was going to provide capability when we needed it. Yep. It was going to provide an enduring industrial base. It was going to create jobs. And most importantly, it was going to provide value for Australians in terms of relevant capability.
It was a cheaper way of getting effective naval capability faster, wasn't it?
Yes, well,
which secure high-paying jobs. I mean, what was not to like?
If you believe that, you know, then there's a number of bridges to sell you. But it is a classic example of inshittification. It was meant to be this fantastic thing that was going to solve all of our problems and work for everybody. But what have we actually got out of it? We are now, if we go back to, say, 2016, when the previous government started this plan approving the attack class submarine. 2017, it put out its naval shipbuilding plan, which, by the way, has not been updated despite promises by both governments.
2018
approval of the Arafura OPV and the Hunter. Where are we at now? We've spent well over $10 billion going down this path.
And we have been inshittified.
We have been massively inshittified. So the attack class, $4 billion gone, nothing for it.
Yep.
And and the thing about inshittification is, at least for some period of time, you've got the IT provider, the platform provider, it's a spider in the middle making lots and lots of money.
Yes.
It's hard to look at
who's the winner here?
Who's the winner here? I mean, certainly Naval, the French shipbuilding company, was making some money, but they've got massively burned over this. We look at the OPV program, which we'll go into more detail later. Who's won out of that? Lursen, the German company that won the contract, they just put out an announcement saying, we're leaving.
Yeah, they've just exited stage left, haven't they? And they were thinking they were a continuous shipbuilding partner.
Correct. And they saw this as, like, I think Naval, as a springboard into these huge Asia-Pacific markets.
Yeah.
So Lursen are gone. They've been burned. You sort of look at their Australian partner, Civmec, and Civmec have got to be thinking, gosh, maybe oil and gas is more reliable than this.
Well, they're a bit like a jilted bride who's now kind of damaged by the experience.
And then, you know, the most grotesque program of all, the Hunter, which is now gone from 30 to 45 billion.
47.
But from 9 down to 6 ships. That's still going, but we're a decade away from having any capability whatsoever. If you look at who is the one winner out of this, you've got to say BAE.
Well, and the UK.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the Hunter plus Snorkus is the kind of insurance policy for BAE, isn't it? It's just a mainline access to the Australian Treasury because they're now too big to fail.
Too big to fail. And unfortunately, Mr. Miles, the Deputy Prime Minister and occasionally seems to be acting as Defence Minister, seems to think the term too big to fail is a good thing.
Yeah.
Newsflash, too big to fail is a bad thing.
Well, Enron.
It is Enron, the US financial sector in the global financial crisis. So.
Yeah, and you can tell yourself you're too big to fail and you can still fail is the other thing about that term. So the OPV, the Arafura class, that's another example, isn't it, of this problem of just you get less and less and less until are you getting anything at all? However, I think the term you've coined for it is the OPV Australia's potential ghost fleet?
Well,
in a good way and a bad way.
Well, so the term ghost fleet, last year, around about this time last year, the US Navy's uncrewed fleet visited Australia. They'd actually been doing operations in the Gulf, in the Middle East, and on their way home, they stopped by here and actually sailed into Sydney Harbour, demonstrating that it's real. To quote a senior Australian Navy officer, it is live.
This wasn't in a test tank, though, was it? It was in Sydney Harbour. Yeah. They sailed up Sydney Harbour.
You know, so there's the US ghost fleet. And I go, well, we also have a ghost fleet, and that is the Arafura class OPV, which six of them are in construction. But what's happened? So, you know, I went back to a reliable source of data, which is the Australian National Audit Office's major projects report. So the first one was meant to be handed over to the Department of Defence in December 2021. So that's nearly 3 years ago. That was shifted. That date was then shifted to January 2024. So even we're almost blown a year past the revised date. And IOC's initial operating capability, so the first one actually be able to be deployed, was meant to be December 2022. So nearly 2 years ago. And that was revised to August 2024. So we've blown past that as well. And you will also recall, Michael, from the surface fleet review that there was a recommendation adopted by the government to cut the original buy of 12 down to six. Because we don't actually know what we want to use these ships for.
Well, there was an elliptic statement about maybe the Navy should think about what they might use these things for because their original purpose doesn't make any sense.
Mm. So we've sort of ended up with this half a fleet, which seems to be largely built, but not accepted into service. We've probably spent $2.5 billion, roughly, so well over half the
dough. And we've had the shipbuilder designer directing mind, Lursen, exit stage left.
Lursen have said, screw this, working with you guys is not worth the effort. So they're going. So, you know, what's behind this? And, of course, Defence is always very close-lipped on this. But, again, going back to the major projects report, it does say, quote, the project is currently managing the following emergent risks. So sea trials are impacted by structural fire integrity design safety.
Mm.
So there seems to be a problem there, and I will say, maybe I'm spreading rumours that I've heard, but I have heard from two people inside Defence who seem to have reasonable familiarity with the program, that there is a major fire safety issue with the design, and that's why Defence doesn't want to accept the ships. Which does, of course, raise that issue of, but wasn't this an existing in-service design?
The Bruneians have this ship. So if there's now this glaring deficiency in the design that is obvious, how did that not get discovered by looking at the Brunei example?
Well, I find it completely perplexing, Michael, because as you know, as we went back to the original selection process for both the OPVs and the future frigate, the government directed Defence to acquire an existing in-service, existing real design. Now, we all know,
to avoid problems like this.
Yes, and we all know the very sorry history of the Hunter class, which did not follow that process at all, and the senior bureaucrats and the military officials in department basically said, screw you, government, we want this
ship. We're doing this anyway,
But in the case of the OPV, we did pick an existing off-the-shelf design.
Mm-hmm.
And so you sort of go, how did we get to this situation where we've built it and gone, oh, we don't think it's seaworthy?
But one thing that occurs to me is, if it's got this major safety and fire issue, has the Australian Defence Organisation and Royal Australian Navy alerted the Bruneians? Because they could be sailing around in a chronic fire hazard. There's a duty of care issue here if they know about this problem. I bet they haven't done that.
I cannot say, Michael, but I do find this to be extremely depressing, and that even when we go completely off the shelf, and we did go off the shelf, well, we did strip some capabilities off it.
Well, it had less fire risk because it had missiles taken off it.
We took the missiles
could explode.
And we downgraded the
helicopter deck.
The helicopter deck.
So it was. It should have been safer because it could do less and it had less explosives on it.
So you do start to wonder, like, what hope is there for us? Like, when we can't even build any.
Let's think positively about this. What should be happening is the safety and compliance problems should be being fixed with this vessel, and we shouldn't throw it away. There are lots of uses for a vessel of that size that could deploy a whole bunch of things in our big, wide Indo-Pacific region. So the worst thing, I think, would be to say, well, that's it, that thing's dead to me, and treat it like a red-haired stepchild. The thing to do is a get-well program and bring it into service, have minimal crew on it.
I do have a red-haired stepchild, and she's very nice. So I do like to think I treat her quite nicely.
Well, there you are. Maybe we should treat them like a good step parent treats a redhead stepchild?
So, look, it's a good question in that when we picked the Arafura and we decided we weren't going to replace the existing patrol boats with similar patrol boats. I will note, however, that because of the OPV problems, we now have replaced the Armidale with the patrol boats with an entire new fleet of
an evolution of the Armidales. Yeah,
this is an opportunity to have that kind of utility vessel that's big enough to do a whole range of things. And I think the historical parallel is the Bathurst class.
From World War II.
From World War II, which were sort of designed as mine sweepers, but we actually used them for a whole range of
tasks.
They
did a bit of escort duty, didn't they?
Yep. So anti-submarine duty, escort duty, troop transport. No doubt many of our listeners are aware that the Royal Australian Navy's only VC winner, so Teddy Sheehan, went down with his ship, HMAS Armidale, when it was sunk by the Japanese.
And also that's another example of great Australian black humour. We have a Prime Minister that drowns, so we have a Harold Holt memorial pool. We have Teddy Sheehan, a hero who goes down firing the gun on his ship as it sinks.
We named a submarine
after him.
But so these were the one thing we know about major conflict. As soon as the proverbial hits the fan, everybody's like, we need more vessels.
You need numbers.
You can't just use cruisers and battleships and aircraft carriers. If you want to do patrol duty, you know, if you want to do escort duty,
well,
you need lots
of little
ships.
The last thing you want to do is turn off a live production line of a cheap and cheerful vessel. Because the Bathurst was cheap and cheerful. If you had any Navy person give you their wet dream requirement about a vessel in World War II, they would not have given you the Bathurst specifications. This is the same.
Right. But all of those sort of kind of jobs of escort or patrolling sea lanes, all of that kind of stuff that we use the Bathurst for. And I thought the OPV could be a modern kind of equivalent for that. You put some UAVs on the back, or you put a towed array on the back.
Stick some mines on it that you can lay somewhere.
Containerized missiles, but no.
Well, you can imagine, I think we've pretty much finished on the OPV. It is a potential ghost fleet. It should be resurrected, and then it's not a ghost, I suppose. But the New Zealand sinking of the Manawanui,
unfortunate.
If you want people to get really nervous about fire and safety risks, pictures of that vessel catching fire and sinking after running aground looks like a commercial specification vessel. That means damage control is
vessel.
Yeah, so damage control is much harder. The thing isn't designed to have separate compartments with integrity that stop it sinking. Yeah, so there are real certification and safety issues, but I'm saying resolve them and have the thing pop out like bunny rabbits.
Well, look, can the credibility of Australia really suffer yet another failed shipbuilding program after blowing $4 billion on the attack class? Can we really afford another failed shipbuilding program?
I mean,
we're starting to look like the US Navy with all of these failed programs.
Well, we're a fast follower of the US Navy, remember? So as the US Navy disappears by failed investments in programs like the Constellation class that is going down the same track that the Hunters are going down.
And the Zumwalt.
We will follow them down that track of shrinking numbers. Maybe, though, the reason for this is the goldfish phenomenon.
The goldfish phenomenon.
The gullible
to this
goldfish.
Before, Michael, tell us about the goldfish phenomenon.
Well, the gullible goldfish is this fish that when it hears something, it gets really excited, feels very positive, and then forgets about it.
Mm.
And it can be this long-lived goldfish years later. The same news is brought out and the gullible goldfish notices it, gets very excited just for a few moments and then forgets again.
Well, I might say that it may only be months in the case of the Australian Defence context.
What are we talking about?
Oh, CRS report.
That was a little joke about me forgetting.
Ah, yeah. Sorry, I fell for it every time.
I'm trying to say the OPVs, because they've been constructed at Henderson. Henderson is being reimaginificated now because there was this big announcement from Richard Miles about the Henderson precinct, which is going to have dry docks for ships and submarines. It's going to be a whole consolidation of shipbuilding there for maintenance and construction purposes.
Okay.
$20 billion, I think, was in the background information provided to journalists. Then
not
you look at,
actually in the media release, though, well, in black and white.
I looked back, Continuous Naval Shipbuilding, Henderson. Then when Continuous Naval Shipbuilding was announced in 2017, Henderson was the second precinct. Mm. It was going to do non-major warship construction with a consolidated rebuilt Henderson precinct. That was 2017. And now here we are in 2024, and lo and behold, the Henderson precinct is going to be consolidated for shipbuilding and maintenance. $20 billion apparently, but then I looked at the actual announcement.
It's not funding, $20
billion? It's not $20 billion, and it's not actually any activity in Henderson. It's pre-feasibility studies of what might potentially be done at Henderson.
For how much money?
$125 million to an engineering advisory company called Bechtel that in about 3 years will produce some potential designs for potential government consideration and perhaps a decision to then tender process.
So 3 years. So it's 3 years and a bit since the AUKUS announcement. Yes. Is that the 3 years you're talking about?
No, and I'm talking about three more years.
Three plus three. So 6 years after the original AUKUS submarine announcement.
Yes.
We will have done the studies to tell us what to do at Henderson.
Well, to allow a decision on potential options for what the Henderson consolidated precinct might be.
Right. So this work is about supporting Submarine Rotation Force West, so the US submarines that will be operating.
I would say the Rotation Force West luckily will happen before these pre-feasibility studies complete. Okay. So the actual submarines can be an input.
The Henderson.
Well, they might, but they can be an input to the pre-feasibility study.
Okay.
And I'm hopeful, actually, that the arrival of the first Australian flag, Virginia, that is meant to happen in 2032, might also help elaborate the post-feasibility potential decision-making.
Okay. So hang on. So late 2024,
yes,
today, another 3 years, end of 2027, that's when we'll know what work we have to do to support submarines and shipbuilding at Henderson.
That's when we'll have a clear set of options about what we might do.
Okay.
And then that would allow a decision to be taken, which would then allow the beginning of a procurement process to begin to specify the requirements for which of those options is accepted that might actually be subject to a tendering and procurement process, which that can't take more than about 4 years after that.
So I'd say
we could be only 7 years from now, which is only 10 years from when AUKUS was begun, we could well have a major contractor identified to begin some construction work in Henderson.
Okay. Now, this announcement, I assume it clarified how this all fits in with the general purpose frigate program, because that's gone out to industry and they're responding and they have to build, well, the first three frigates will be built in their home yard, but the next eight will be built at Henderson. Now, we already have two shipbuilders at Henderson. We've got Austal and we've got Civmec. So does that actually explain how all that's meant to work? So if I'm, say, the Japanese Mitsubishi Heavy Industries bidding, putting forward my frigate, does that explain what's going on to them? Like, who's going to own the shipyard? Will they be amalgamated? Will it be government-owned ship? Does it say anything there?
Well, that's not covered in the announcement, but I think the only sensible thing to do is to delay that building program until the Henderson precinct is designed and constructed, because the real danger here, the big danger for continuous shipbuilding in our country, is people get ahead of themselves.
Something.
They get ahead of themselves. And so if you've got someone like Mitsubishi or the South Koreans piling in there to Henderson building a ship, just when you're trying to get the precinct right, that's just going to get in the way, isn't it? So I would hope they're going to delay that build of the general purpose frigate until sometime in the mid-2030s to allow the world's best digital shipyard and maintenance facility to be constructed at Henderson.
Well, I'm just sort of trying to do the maths here, because the first three general purpose frigates, first one's meant to come around, say, 2029, built overseas, and then you get the next ones in 2030, 31, 32. So we'll be hoping to get the first Australian-built one in 2033. So
it takes you 3 years to build the thing. You've got to have the facility to build it in operating in 2030.
Well, I mean, I'd say well before then, but I don't know. The numbers, the timeline's looking pretty tight here, Michael.
I think
we need to do a study into the feasibility of the timelines.
I just think we need to look forward to the next announcement of a potential future option for decision.
But the good thing I will say is that with the Henderson precinct announcement, the government did put out a cartoon of what the ship built.
That's true. I mean, a $20 billion announcement that turned into a $125 million pre-feasibility study.
With a cartoon.
With a small cartoon.
I'm looking at there's some sheds. I mean, it's pretty good. There's some sheds. There's a couple of ships. There's a thing called a floating dock. And there is a depot level maintenance I mean, so I, it's all there. I mean, what more do you need?
You know what was missing from that cartoon?
The 10,000 workers?
There was no
any workers there.
But the other thing that was missing was that little warning on the bottom. You know, artist illustration, resemblance to anything real or imagined is only elliptic.
It does say indicative pictorial of some elements of the proposed Henderson Defence precinct.
It is very funny, isn't it?
Which will be refined as planning, design and feasibility studies are progressed.
Yeah. But the goldfish
precinct boundaries are to be determined. So we don't actually know where the precinct is.
Well, and it's not all obviously in Commonwealth ownership. There's a lot of private ownership. There'll be some state government ownership. Just the planning and development process is years long after the pre-feasibility. Anyway, the Gullible Goldfish was very happy to get that announcement. And the Gullible Goldfish had only just assimilated another problem, which was the Congressional Research Service in America had come out with this extraordinary report saying that at the time of the AUKUS submarine announcement, there was no proper analysis of alternatives, saying whether this was the best path or whether something else, like B-21s, might have been a more viable and effective
path. And they kindly proposed some other options.
They did. They said.
So, but when did this report come out, Michael?
It was just this month.
But hang on, didn't we cover this?
Well, that's because
a year ago.
Yes, but that's because this is an update to a series of reports, and the Congressional Research Service has been making this point in these reports for over a year now.
So, hang on, what you're saying is there's nothing new in this big media flash that has caught everybody's attention.
Well, the goldfish saw it, and so the goldfish was alarmed. But I think it's a very good thing that this excellent analysis by the Congressional Research Service is now circulating in Australia. But I expect the goldfish to go back to sleep again and only be surprised when the next version of this report comes out.
Look, I will make a serious point about the CRS report. So there's a couple of things. First is, yes, the CRS, they simply provide advice to Congress about upcoming decisions that Congress will have to make, essentially to approve legislation and spending put forward by the administration.
To give them a good information basis to make decisions.
So what the CRS is saying is not anything put forward by the administration. It is certainly not the Biden administration's position, is certainly not the position of any congressional committee. So it is simply
analysis done over here.
What is interesting, however, is as somebody who's been consuming CRS reports for many years, and they are excellent, the gold standard, I can't remember them ever actually doing something like this, of actually proposing
alternatives
other than what the administration is proposing to Congress.
Yes.
And to me, it's a sense of their kind of frustration at AUKUS, at the ham-fisted way that Australia got into it without proper analysis, you know, without the sort of due diligence that they would expect a country like Australia, which they see as analogous to the US as a robust Western democracy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think they're kind of frustrated, partly because they're going, they've seen the decline of the US Navy over the last sort of 30 years as the inshittification of US naval shipbuilding.
There's an implicit thought in that Congressional Research Service report that Australia is better than this, that we're smarter and that we won't fall into the same obvious pitfall of declining capability that the US Navy is in.
Yeah, so they're sort of disappointed that we've done as badly as the US. But I think there is also genuine concern there that, hang on, the US Navy is going backwards in terms of ship and submarine numbers. How is that going to be helped by handing submarines over to Australia? So I think there is genuine concern there. So it's it's important stuff. Yes, it is just a little funny that it's been out for over a year and the media have rediscovered it once again.
Well, I think it's good people are reading those reports, and I hope they read further reports also from people like the Congressional Budget Office, because that kind of analysis is not available here in Australia. Now, analysis not available here in Australia brings me to the last issue, which is about missiles.
Mm.
So the Gullible Goldfish, again, has been very excited to learn today when we're recording this podcast that there's been a deal, a $7 billion deal struck with the Americans by Industry and Capability Delivery Minister Pat Conroy to get SM-2 Block 3C missiles for our Navy ships, mm-hmm. and also SM-6 missiles. And he said this is a wonderful example of this government accelerating capability.
Accelerating. Is this the word we don't think it means what you think it means?
Well, Inigo Montoya made that point. Yes, here is Pat Conroy demonstrating that he doesn't know what acceleration means in normal parlance.
As I cast my mind back, I seem to recall the previous government announcing SM-6 numerous times, actually, mm-hmm. and announcing a cooperative program with the US where we would participate in the development of SM-6. So
yes.
I'm sort of, which bit of this is new?
Well, I looked at the DSCA site, which is the US body that approves these sales and notifies Congress. Mm-hmm. And there was a 26th of October announcement there about SM-2s, about Australia getting 17 of them mm-hmm. for $46 million US.
October this year?
Well, it turns out it was 2010, actually, 14 years ago. So after 14 years, we are now buying some actual missiles for use, apparently.
Look, we have bought actual SM-2s and we do have them on our three actual
I'm just saying, this is not a new program. SM-6 this is not acceleration.
Has been announced many, many times. Now,
SM-6,
in the recent announcement, does it say when we're actually going to have real SM-6s on a real Australian warship? Does it give a date there?
What is missing in Minister Conroy's accelerated announcement is a time frame for getting these weapons.
It's a bit hard to measure acceleration.
Numbers
without time.
Of missiles that are being acquired, and any detail about resupply, or is this just a one-off purchase? Mm-hmm. So,
and which ships are they going on?
They're going on three ships that the Navy actually has.
The
Hobart class air warfare
destroyers.
You mean
the ones that are about to go into an extensive upgrade?
The ones that are going out of service for an extensive upgrade,
so they can use the SM-6.
That's right.
Yes.
But they're also potentially going on the general purpose frigates, and you'll be pleased to know the Hunter frigates.
The Hunter. When is the first Hunter going to be in service?
If it's on schedule, I think... the Navy gets it in 2032. It probably won't be operational for another
IOC
couple of years.
I think IOC is 2034. So.
Yeah. Okay. So a decade from now.
We might actually have some SM-6s by then.
Well, you can see why we've got to accelerate this. Mm. So this is another major example of this disconnect between words and reality. All this talk of acceleration, equipping our ships with defensive capabilities, because these are predominantly defensive missiles. You can use both missiles to hit ships, but it's a very expensive, bad way of doing it. Very expensive, bad way of doing it. But this, in the 2016 Defence White Paper, there was air and missile defence as a priority. In the 2020 force structure review of the previous government, there was $15 to $22 billion for air and missile defence and separate money for maritime defence. Now we're getting an announcement about $7 billion, which is about a third of what was in the previous budget plan. And we're being told it's accelerated, but it's being fitted mainly to ships that the Navy isn't going to get for a decade or more. The thing is beyond parity.
It is. There is a certain black humour to this, I have to say. But I think we can maybe make some sense of it if we refer to this little booklet that you were kind enough to share with me.
Well, I had to turn up to a police station, and not for any crime I'd committed. It was for another purpose that I won't bore listeners with. But I picked up this thing.
And it is called the Little Black Book of Scams.
And it's from the Anti-Scam Centre, the National Anti-Scam Centre.
And I was flipping through this, and here are some of the scams we need to be looking out for. First one, impersonation scams. Scammers deceive you into thinking they are from trusted organizations such as the police, government, banks, and well-known businesses. I mean, that sounds a bit like naval shipbuilding. We're from the government.
Yeah, you can trust us.
We're going to work with this large, well-known business to deliver you some ships. Believe us.
Scam alert.
Another scam. Jobs and employment scams. Scammers offer jobs that pay well with little effort. They pretend to be hiring on behalf of high-profile companies. Sometimes the job they list doesn't even exist, such as
shipbuilding in Henderson, submarine building,
construction workers in Western Australian shipyards. And And but I think this is probably the one we really need to look out for most of all.
Is this an AUKUS alert?
Yes. Romance scams. Scammers use the promise of love, dating or friendship to get your money. They go to great lengths to convince you the relationship is real and manipulate you to give them money. Now, my own editorial comment here is generally the scams work because the victim, the sucker, is only too willing to hand over the money. They can't do it fast enough, and perhaps the $4.7 billion we're handing to the US and the other $4.7 billion we're handing to the UK, our other online dating scammer, is an illustration of there is still a sucker born every minute.
Well, I've got a more positive view of this. It shows to me that in our troubled, dangerous, fragmenting world, that romance is not dead. So I actually think it's beautiful about the Australian character that we can fall in love and that we are trusting.
Anyway, the Little Black Book of Scams. Richard Miles might want to go and get a copy from his local police station, and maybe it'll open his eyes a little to some potential pitfalls out there. But finally, we have one final piece of good news.
There is some good news. Tanks, my friend. Tanks. So after over a year of deep cogitation, Richard Miles has announced that 49 of Australia's 59 retiring M1 A1 Abrams tanks are being given to Ukraine. So this is
very hard,
good news.
Complex decision, Michael. I mean, a lot of factors to consider.
Many factors. I think one of them, from what I heard, a big factor here was when the Defence Disposals Boards got their hands on these tanks, they used their best equipment, but they just
sharpest chainsaw,
biggest spanners. They just could not cut into these things. I mean, the MRH-90 helicopters were child's play.
Easy. I mean, they're composites.
I mean, in the interest of protecting the health and safety of those disposals people that did such a rapid job with the Type A helicopters, mm-hmm. there had to be another path.
All right.
And the Ukrainians are the beneficiaries.
That leads to Ukraine.
Although, again, this announcement, no detail of timeline, no detail of the logistics package that's going, no detail at all. And in fact, just a disturbing little rider that's something about, well, now it's up to us getting the requisite approvals from the US government about this transfer. So I just hear a series of roadblocks in the way of these tanks actually getting to the Ukrainians. Mm-hmm. And I would like some honesty and openness from the government about the timeline for mm-hmm. implementation of this decision.
Honesty and openness about timelines. Well, I think that could be a little challenging.
Well, if we don't get it, it'll be yet another chapter in the Little Book of Scams.
Well, and hopefully we're not going to strip them for parts to sell on the open market before we send them.
Yeah, well, I'll be watching Pickle's online auctions for M1, A1 parts for that purpose.
And, look, I will also just note that Mr. Miles has, emphasised the scale of Australia's contributions to Ukraine fighting the good fight. But if you actually do the math, it turns out that each Australian, the government has given to Ukraine on behalf of each Australian, by my calculation, well under 50 cents a week since the start of the war.
So, Australians are paying even more for the ABC, aren't they?
So, I don't think, we can say we've been overly generous in supporting Ukraine's fight
for
survival and
democracy.
Well,
there's a smarter way to help the Ukrainians, aside from giving them our cast-offs from our own military, and that is to give Australian companies that make stuff the Ukrainians want desperately contracts, because then that money goes to Aussie jobs and the Aussie economy. My view about these numbers we get from the government about military support to Ukraine is it's the only area of government activity where they're pro-inflation. Anyway, it's still good news. So let's end on that happy note.
All right.
And let's hope there's more good news that doesn't take an agonised year to make an obvious decision. Marcus, great to talk with you.
Thank you, Michael.